Hello, welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader from Flagstaff, Deborah McFadder, with excerpts from Yes, a nonprofit independent publisher of solutions journalism. We'll begin today with the column Excerpt. This article is called Chronicling the Messy Truth of Cancer by Caitlin Breedlove, first published March 12, 2024. The illustration that begins this is a drawing with a pink background and many different colored flowers and leaves on it in different shades of pink and magenta, some green leaves with red berries on them. And in the center is a woman's figure in a pale lavender dress. She has dark hair with one of these flowers behind her right ear. She's also wearing a ribbon in the color of turquoise that's folded across her shoulder. After her cervical cancer diagnosis, Caitlin Breedlove sought connection and stories from other survivors, but found them few and far between. The process of illness that brings us near death is often a process of erasure. We lie between life and death, and most people avert their gaze from us. Most of us in this country also avoid dwelling too much on the dead themselves, though they are unfathomably legion and ever-present. They are the water we drink, the land we walk on, the food we eat, the cells we are made of. We are afraid, and yet we are obsessed, scaring ourselves with zombie movies. But the real undead, unalive, those of us who hang in a certain balance, are largely ignored. We elicit pity, guilt, and discomfort. Our stories are told for us. People run marathons on our behalf. The half-dead, the near-dead, the undead. Our presence can be frightening. But witches say, where there is fear, there is power. There is power in what we fear. There is a power we wield when we are feared. It is a time in the world where these sayings, these stories, and those worldviews must be shared widely again. I developed ovarian cancer in my late 30s. Ovarian cancer kills the vast majority of its victims. There are few survivors. This is largely because there is limited testing, and it is almost always caught too late. Its symptoms are so generic, bloating, fatigue, that any tired woman would not notice them, and most poor and working-class women would simply endure them. In January 2021, while our world endured the isolation of COVID-19, I received a quick spiral of diagnoses that resulted in 3 cancer-related surgeries in less than 3 months. The winter of 2020 started with relief. Many of us had worked hard and relatively well together to defeat Trump. The previous 4 years of his presidency had brought me back to my organizing spirit, and while my peers and I were overworked and worn out, I felt some measure of calm when he was voted out. Alongside the battles of 2020, a small spirit had been warmly pestering me, like a child asking to be born. She brought me messages, bodily communiques that doctors call symptoms. These resulted in a diagnosis of ovarian cancer, the deadliest of all gynecological cancers, and one that disproportionately impacts queer women, trans men, Jewish women of Eastern European descent, and older women. It feeds on those who can't go to a doctor and those who convince themselves we do not need to. It is a cancer that lives and grows far inside the body. In my case, it came to me after years of terribly painful periods with days of cramps and heavy bleeding. Continuous travel for work meant I rarely went to see a doctor. I told myself that I ate all right and exercised. I had visited a gynecologist a few times, but they had not figured out what was wrong and only suggested birth control pills, which I politely would refuse. In retrospect, practically bleeding out and through my jeans in an airplane bathroom several times over the years was not normal. But the machine of overwork often convinces us our pain is normal, setting our standards of suffering to autopilot, set to run until we just fall down one day. I have had 6 reproductive organs removed. Each one died and went into the earth before the rest of my body. This was a sacrifice I made at men's altar of blood and steel and science, a sacrifice I made to keep living in this wondrous body, to keep enjoying her purpose and pleasures. The Baba Yagas, goddesses and grandmother spirits of Central and Eastern Europe, and other spiritual forces in my life will, in time, tell me if this sacrifice was enough to save my life, but for now, it seems yes. I am told my diagnosis was quite unusual, that I was quite young for it. It has not served me to think of it this way. I refuse the idea it is unique, especially in the great cycle of loss and grief we all live in and through now. Instead, I felt it connecting me, as if on a threshold, to an array of spirits and humans. No saccharine optimism to be found, but such aliveness poured in and through me that I had moments of feeling dazzled. When I was in treatment, I felt I was nearly being killed to save my life. At that time, I searched the internet for books written by ovarian cancer survivors. There were few. I discovered why when I went to online ovarian cancer support groups. Everyone was slowly or quickly dying in those groups except me. Most of those suffering from this cancer likely simply died before they could consider writing anything. Then I searched for any books by women who had had any kind of cancer. I found some. Many felt like sugary, optimistic fairy tales bathed in Pepto-Bismol pink. They were also overwhelmingly the stories of Christian, wealthy, white, straight women. There were also many films, books, and articles written by people who loved people with cancer and who had lost people to cancer, lovers, parents, and siblings. The lives of cancer victims and survivors impact those around us deeply, and others are often moved to speak for us. This has advantages and disadvantages, of course. We also must reserve the space and support to speak for ourselves. This made the few books I found that were completely different all the more precious, most notably The Cancer Journals by Audre Lorde, which stands alone. She remains the only woman writer who lived with cancer I have ever read, who wrote with raw truth about what it meant for her body, her sexuality, her mind, her relationships, and her children to suffer like this. She was taken from us far too soon. As I floated in my bed during chemotherapy, high on opioids, I deeply wanted to read, when I could read, stories I could relate to, about the raw, the eternal, the visceral, the pessimistic, the women, the queers, the dead who talk to us when we are near their realm. I didn't want to hear the stories of praying to a God that was not mine. I was hungry to read about women grappling with cancer who were divorced, single moms, who came, as I did, from immigrant families, who had family far away, who were suffering through cancer on land that was not theirs and would never be. I did not feel the need to share every experience of these women. I just wanted to hear the pushed-out stories at the margins, which are really the stories of most of us. 1 in 3 women in the U.S. will deal with cancer at some point in their lives, and each year there are more cancer cases among people under 50. It seems to me some of us must chronicle the messy truths of it so that more of us can care for each other better in a time of profound alienation and isolation. Few have written about what it is to suffer cancer surgeries and treatment during a pandemic. This experience only underscored and deepened the solitude intrinsic to all of us who come close to death, all of us who must build a new life. When I was a child, I was told one story about the history of the plant hemlock. One of the highest honors told in the stories of witch burnings was when one witch would smuggle hemlock to her tortured and imprisoned sisters, the ultimate sign of respect, allowing each to choose how much pain she wanted to take before ending her own life. At the heart of Slavic belief, indigenous to Eastern Europe and part of my heritage, are the ideas of immanence, that all things are alive and sacred. The love and the wrath of the earth are poured out upon us. Our deaths, our near deaths, our salvation, and our new lives are all catalysts for transformation in which we have some choice, some power, even when we feel we do not. There is no end, no beginning, and there never was. I made choices in my near death. I made choices in my new life. My reasons were my own and would be different from anyone else. I owe a great deal to the legacy of feminist literature, particularly chronicling the idea that it is inherently political and liberatory to chronicle painstakingly in natural and raw time the experiences of those who are often erased and silenced. When we speak, Lourdes says, we are afraid our words will not be heard or welcomed. But when we are silent, we are still afraid. So it is better to speak, remembering we were never meant to survive. I can only thank my ancestors here, and again 8 times a year, for how they stayed close on this journey, ready for me if I were to cross to their side. So many women in my lineage have suffered sorrow and regret silently. They urge me to speak. The honor of my life is to give voice in places they never could. These words are for all of us who know in our bones or seek a different way of being alive, nearing death, suffering, and even dying. They are for all of us who love someone going through these cycles. They are for all of us who want to reach beyond the numbing gauze of our times to know what suffering means, to be fully alive again in order to be whole again and always. This excerpt from All In, Cancer, Near Death, New Life, by Caitlin Breedlove, appears by permission of the publisher. About the author, Caitlin Breedlove has been organizing, writing, and building movements in red states for the last 20 years, and working across lines of race, class, culture, gender, sexuality, and faith. All In is her first book. You are tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, listening to excerpts from Yes. Next, we move into an article called Culture Shift. And this particular part of it is themed At Home in Exile, the stolen souls aboard the Clotilda slave ship's final illegal voyage remain suspended across space and time. This is written by Jen M. Jackson, first published March 4th, 2024. Now, it's kind of interesting. This article begins with old black and white photographs. One of them on the left is an older African-American person. And in the photograph, it's really hard to tell if this is a female or a male. They have very white, short hair. And they're wearing a V-necked sweater over a plaid shirt. The background behind them is sort of a mottled gray and white. Then next to it, there's a picture of a very large stone or brick building built in an old-fashioned style with towers on the corners of the building that have pointed turret roofs. It has columns at the very front of where the entrance is, and in front of that on the drive or the lawn is a horse and buggy. If I didn't define myself for myself, I would be crunched into other people's fantasies for me and eaten alive. Quote by Audre Lorde. As a person of trans experience, I think frequently about what it has meant to name myself. As a child, pink frilled dresses, shiny patent leather Mary Janes, and itchy white stockings signaled to the world that I was a girl. I was gendered female, and as a result, my surrounding community followed a host of spoken and unspoken cues about how to raise me, how to punish me, and how to limit my access to joy. Even now, as an agender and androgynous person, I feel the lingering effects of those lessons. They're so familiar to me, caressing my cheeks like a mother's touch. But I am not a girl. I've never been a girl. And now pronouns like she and her clank against my body, a ringing reminder that the world will always have a role for me. While reading Hannah Durkin's 2024 book, The Survivors of the Clotilda, The Lost Stories of the Last Captives of the American Slave Trade, this experience, being violently and permanently cast in a role, renamed and remade, assaulted, beaten, and forced into conditions not made for human souls, kept coming up for me. Even after the conditions of that casting have fallen away, we still feel the tremors. Now, the picture that I described earlier to you actually has a label here now. It's Matilda McCreer, the last known survivor of La Clotilda, is one of the many told by British historian Hannah Durkin in her new book. Though Matilda was kidnapped and trafficked from West Africa at age 2, she wore her hair in a Yoruba style until her death in 1940, and so that explains the kind of hairdo that she has in this photograph that was very short. Durkin's book offers a small look into what that experience may have been like for the Yoruba-speaking people who were kidnapped from villages in what would be present-day southwest Nigeria, extending into Benin and Togo, and sold into enslavement. These people, who mostly worked as farmers and foragers, were kidnapped in the mid-19th century as the transatlantic slave trade became heavily reliant on indigenous captors, in this case, the Dahomey warriors, to supply enslavers with prisoners from African tribes in neighboring communities. Many of those taken were children or young adults, considered too young to undergo the rites of passage that would signal adulthood in their communities. This meant they were essentially nameless and without the belonging of older villagers. While the 2022 hit film The Woman King chronicled Dahomey tribe's role in the slave trade, the book Survivors of the Clotilda tells another side of the story. The Dahomey, who were also vulnerable to captivity and enslavement, aligned with white captors out of self-preservation and scarcity, hallmarks of global racial capitalism. Dahomey's imperial growth and engagement in this trade was probably precipitated by a desire to protect its own citizens against the threat of transatlantic enslavement, Durkin writes. As Durkin notes, enslaved people rarely kept their original names. Instead, they were met with terror from the moment they encountered Dahomey fighters, who often ripped them from their communities under the cloak of night. They were made to watch their fellow townspeople decapitated and maimed. Then they were forced to march alongside the heads of the slain as a reminder to never rebel. The Dahomey kept them in putrid conditions until white slavers came to collect their human goods. The Dahomey knew that to be part of one's own tribe, one's own people, was to act as if one was human. And in the eyes of white captors, the Yoruba-speaking captives certainly were not. The stolen souls hidden in the cargo hold of the Clotilda were suspended across space and time in what Durkin calls transatlantic dislocation. During the transition from their homes to a foreign land, they became unnamed and unpossessed vessels, available for a white patriarchal culture to pour into and assign meaning. As scholar Hortense Spillers writes in her 1987 Diacritics article, Mama's Baby, Papa's Maybe, these captive persons without names their captors would recognize were in movement across the Atlantic, but they were also nowhere at all. Now we find the caption of the old building that I told you about earlier. The author, Durkin, was researching another Clotilda survivor, Sally Rhodesie Smith, when she came across an interview with McCreer in the Selma Times Journal in 1931. In 1931, McCreer, then in her 70s, trekked 15 miles from her rural home to the Dallas County Courthouse in Selma, Alabama, to ask for compensation for herself and Smith. The claim was denied. And so this building that we see is the courthouse. It's an unimaginable sensation, being ripped away from everything and everyone one knows and sent along an unknown journey. Cast in darkness, veiled by the intentions of the ship's masters, this voyage was dually defined by the power and privilege of wealthy slavers and the refashioning of the African townspeople and children into tradable commodities. These humans were rendered invisible by a system meant to wash away the African continent and its various traditions, ceremonies, and practices. That's the reason the Clotilda, the ship at the center of Durkin's book, is so important. Its final voyage in March 1860 was not only unsanctioned, but also one of many expeditions meant to steal humans from the continent of Africa, forcing souls into slavery, even as anti-slavery sentiment was growing across the globe. It is no wonder that the Yoruba-speaking people on the Clotilde's last expedition, a liminal tribe formed along the waves of the Middle Passage, thought their captors were going to eat them. Fears of white cannibalism were widespread throughout West Africa during the era of the transatlantic slave trade, Durkin writes, before mentioning abolitionist Alauda Equiano's 1789 memoir, in which he wrote about his abject terror of being eaten. At the time, rumors were circulating along slave ports in southwest Africa that these white-skinned, gibberish-speaking people were not only slavers, but in the business of consuming human flesh. As a result, though many of the captives on the Clotilda were starved to within inches of their lives, some still chose not to eat for fear it would make them more enticing prey for cannibalistic white captors. Young girls and women who survived the bowels of the Clotilda were met with another flesh-eating monster, the plantation's systematic sexual, physical, and child abuse. Captives were transported along the Alabama River to southern Alabama and eastern Mississippi, an area called the Black Belt due to its rich, dark soil. This region, known for its sweltering temperatures, was fueled by barbaric slavers who cracked their whips, forced sexual relations between enslaved people, and maimed their slaves to keep them from escaping along the Underground Railroad. Durkin tells the story of one Clotilda survivor, Dinah, who was so small when she arrived at the Black Belt at age 13 that she was sold for a dime to a vicious slave owner named Timothy Mehrer, M-E-A-H-E-R. When she was taken to Mehrer's plantation, Dinah was housed with two indigenous men and two white Americans for the sole purpose of subjecting Dinah to repeated rapes with the hope of her becoming pregnant. Mehrer's goals weren't unique. He and other slavers wanted to take advantage of the partus sequitur ventrum legal ordinance established by the state of Virginia, which mandated that children born to enslaved women took on the condition of their mother. This meant that, no matter the freedom status of their biological father, children born to enslaved black women were already in bondage. Now we have another black and white photograph. And this is the person Olole Kusula, also known as Kuju Lewis, the perhaps best-known survivor of the Clotilda. He's wearing a white shirt, long-sleeved shirt, that is buttoned up with a small stand-up round collar. He's an older man, black man, and he's almost all bald except for a little ring of white hair around the side of his head, and he has a white mustache and a short beard. He is holding a cane in his right hand, and his other hand is resting across his lap. His trousers appear to be torn or scruffed denim. This lack of legal protection for enslaved black women and girls was often exploited by white slave owners who would, themselves, repeatedly rape their captives. These women could neither consent nor deny the advances of any man, especially not their master. Their flesh was not theirs. One slaver named Charles Tate used this loophole to abuse young girls he enslaved, leading to 58 enslaved children being born on Tate's property between 1819 and 1834. When Dinah became pregnant, another pubescent enslaved child was sent into the slave quarters to take her place. In this way, enslavement became a way to make and remake gender. It labeled young girls and women's bodies as not only property of their slave owners, but also of the enslaved men with whom they shared quarters. The visceral and vulnerable nature of captivity made the ecosystem of slavery not only radicalized, but deeply gendered. Another black and white photograph shows up here. This is inside of a cabin of some sort. Some of the walls are logs or wood that has been put up. Some of the walls are covered with what appears to be old newspaper. In a straight back cane bottom chair sits one of the people who is a survivor of the Clotilda, and he's sitting in front of a fireplace with a fire blazing. I think it's probably the same man I just described to you in the previous picture. He has on the same kind of shirt. There are some shelves on the walls that hold some utensils and a couple of hats that look like they're hanging on hooks on the wall. The caption tells us that after emancipation, Casula and other Clotilda survivors, many in their teens and early 20s, established an independent community north of Mobile, Alabama, which they named Africatown. The society was governed by values and social structures they had retained from their Yoruba youth in West Africa. Even after the abolishment of slavery, the surviving members of the Clotilda tribe longed to return to their homeland rather than settle on a land where they'd experienced so much brutality. They searched for a way back to the lush trees and the smell of fruit in the air, the smell of home. But the road home never came for them. Instead, they remained in exile for the rest of their lives, struggling to define freedom in a place they called Africatown in modern-day Mobile, Alabama, where they were surrounded by other previously enslaved black people. Perhaps this history resonates so deeply with me because there are parts of me that always feel exiled, even when I'm at home. There are parts of me that long to return to a place that I neither concretely remember nor possess evidence of ever having been. It's a strange and peculiar feeling to be permanently displaced and to have to accept that displacement because it's the only way forward. But then there are the tremors, the memories, the aftershocks. The trauma never leaves the body, and the specter always looms over the flesh. Freedom, though tangible, is always textured by this tension of being eaten alive and spit back out. The flesh is never the same. The author is a black woman abolitionist, lover of all black people, an assistant professor at Syracuse University's Department of Political Science. Their books include Black Women Taught Us and Policing Blackness, forthcoming in 2023. You have been tuned to Sunsounds of Arizona, listening to excerpts from Yes Media. I'm your volunteer reader from Flagstaff, Deborah McFadder. Thanks a lot for listening.